touch on tonight. I'm not going to be able to do the whole subject in the way it should be done, is the last of the issues having to do with cooling stuff that derives from a non-kosher source, and that's the issue of gelatin. Before we do that, I just want to pass out a shiva of Moshe Feinstein on the issue of confectioner's glaze. So we'll not study it in detail, but I have a huge amount of time to spend it. But. Okay, so this is something that we mentioned last time. The Dvar HaShalak. This is Shalak. Shehu Dvar HaYotzei Minin Cholahim, which is something that comes from bugs. Really, what do you know? The end of the Tarova. So I'll just read the introductory paragraph and then upon the decision. Hinei b'dvar ha-shalak sh'bam yitrala'im yam kimis ha'af gilam nagua. These are bugs which suck on certain types of trees. The eino mitmatzei migufo. It's not something which is purely a product of the body of the bug. Sh'yotzei migufo ha-tola'im mitkashek ha'etz al-yidei ha'avir. Crystallizes, and when they take it from the tree, because it becomes wrapped on the branches, the refinery nasets a little kamayim, they take it to a refinery where it's purified, so that there are no portions of the actual bugs left. Alcohol, the Shalosh arava chalakim alcohol achelak yachad shel shalak. It's mixed in a proportion of 4 or 5, 3 or 4 to 1 of alcohol. Umizeh liten al candy ufidalmami b'chutz. And then this is put on candy. Lo l'ta'am, not in order to give any taste to the candy. Ela l'hamid hazohar shenaseh al candy. But to keep the shine on the candy, which is made from sugar. Ba'udmi minshi hazohar yanim arvim mitzad she... Mekasher, because this hardens. V'ashalek atzmo ein lo gam chazuta. It also has this transparent. The nikra confectioner's glaze. Shabbat v'otar atel leheter v'otzi v'itein dati gam dati haniya. So can you use this?
I should hear it,
yeah? Yes. You want two together?
Shellac is today entirely different than something you put on here. It's unedible.
Yeah, but where does it come from?
To me, it's a petroleum derivative.
No, no, it's mostly good shellac comes from the resin that these bugs exuded from the trees. So I passed out the business on lac.
Last week.
So the point is, I don't want to go into detail on this because this is not going to be the main topic of tonight. But Moshe again permits this situation for various reasons. One, first of all, since this is not actually part of the bugs, but only an exude from the bug, and it's not clear that it's an exude, but rather it's really the substance of the tree that's passed through the bug. Like the whole discussion that we had with Punish. But his final conclusion is that we should not worry about confectioner's glaze on candies.
Why do we worry about eggs from a fish? I mean, it's an egg strain.
Well, he's saying two different things. First of all, he's saying that this is not produced by the bug, but simply the sap of the tree, which has passed through the bug, just like the Gemara says about honey, that it's not the processes the honey, but doesn't produce the honey. It may add some enzymes to it, but it's not actually the product. And secondly, it's not edible. It has no flavor, it has no taste, in contrast to roe or fish, yeah, where it has a flavor and it's a product of the fish. So that's the difference.
Not be allowed like eggs in the plate, you know.
Not allowed.
Right.
Okay. Now let's get on to what I want to discuss tonight, and this is a rather large subject from a historical point of view and from a practical point of view. So let me pass out various items, lay down the items as we go home tonight. One is copies from two journals appearing in 1952. That was a crucial year as far as the issue of gelatin is concerned, where gelatin was transformed from something which was generally accepted as being kosher to something which was generally accepted as being non-kosher. And the two journals involved were Hamaor, which is a journal produced in Brooklyn, that was the first year of its publication, and Hapardes, which was in its something like 18th or 19th year of publication. And there was...
Did you know that the Hapardes from Chicago?
No, I did not know any of the... Most of... Let me be a little bit more precise. The person who, as you correctly said, the person who instigated the heter was Rabbi Parks of Chicago. Did you know him?
No, I mean, I didn't know
my work.
So,
I went to Chicago.
I don't want to be heard.
Right.
So,
one of his articles.
The key players here in the United States was, of course, Rabbi Parks. And well, and on one side, and Rabbi Eliezer Silver, who you do remember, a flamboyant character,
Cincinnati.
On the other side. So all what I've just passed out is a whole collection of different articles by various rabbis in these two journals from 1952.
Okay.
He's
not in here.
Hardis is not in. Well, I will pass out something involving Rabbi Parks in a moment.
I might have it at the house. That's why I'm very interested.
Okay.
I have some of my old Parks.
The early correspondence is a heter that Rabbi Parks gave in the early 30s to Gelatin, and for which she acquired the approval of Chaim Osovitzinski. The early tshuva from the Yadol Hadar, one of the great scholars of the time, was from Chaim Osovitzinski, was in response to a letter from Rabbi Parks, and that's going to be in here. And then a second letter from Rabbi Konvitz, who was the head of the Agudas Sarabonim at that time in the 1930s, also wanting the permission to use a gelatin which was made from various non-kosher sources. In both cases, Rabbi Chaim Rosa permitted the use of gelatin, and as we saw last week, the Chazon Ish also permitted the use of gelatin. And in fact, maybe I will read some of the history of the subject from a book entitled Gelatin in Jewish Law by a Rabbi David I. Sheinkopf. I do not know Rabbi Sheinkopf personally. He was in Springfield for a while, and then he moved to Syracuse. He
was Rabbi Simple in Springfield.
He gives a hefshu to Daniel,
and also,
and therefore he is a party to. He's, truth in advertising therefore requires that you have to realize that he's a party to this dispute.
He had this opinion long before Dan Gilbert had gone.
Well, to put things in perspective, his father gave the hefshu to Kogel at the time that Kogel was made from bones of non-kosher animals.
What was that? Whose father?
Rabbi Sheinkopf's father.
He gives a hefshu to
and now he gives
jelly rings.
To jelly rings and to all various forms of what are called kosher gelatin, which are, of course, are made, in fact, from non-kosher sources. So he represents the minority opinion in the United States as far as what the law currently is. But nevertheless, most of the content of what he describes is reasonably accurate, and where he doesn't quite get the story right, I can describe it, what is happening. So I'm going to first just begin by reading from his chapters 1 and 2. I did not Xerox this because I figured there's some copyright rules.
What's the date of the book?
The date of this book originally appeared in 1982. I think it's been reissued, and also been reissued as part of a larger book, more recent. So, I'm just going to read from him until we get back to the subject matter. For years, the subject of continuing inquiry and debate gelatin has acquired an impressive literary history in Jewish lore. Okay. Oh, Shem Aleichem, how are you, John? First, the first written decision explicitly favoring its acceptance was sent in 1935 by Rabbi Chaim Moshe Brzezinski of Vilna, the leading rabbinical authority of his day, Rabbi Samuel Aaron Parvis of Chicago. In this letter, Rabbi Brzezinski confirmed the halakhic rationale proposed by Rabbi Parvis for the approval of a gelatin product made of cattle bones and or hides. He added, however, that since not all gelatin manufacturing procedures were identical, his approval of the process described by Rabbi Parvis should not be misconstrued as a blanket endorsement of every type of gelatin produced. A year later, Rabbi Brzezinski was asked about bone gelatin by Rabbi Joseph Kamditz, then president of the Akudat HaRabbanim, the Union of Orthodox Rabbis of the United States and Canada. Rabbi Kamditz, it should be noted, had himself found ample reason for accepting gelatin as kosher, but, like Rabbi Parvis, sought validation from a scholar he considered his superior. In replying to this inquiry, Rabbi Brzezinski adduced proofs from the entire range of Jewish law. He reiterated the sources cited by Rabbi Kamditz and drew an analogy between the manufacturing process of gelatin and that of tartaric acid, Weinstein. What?
Weinstein is classroom.
The
tartaric acid is Weinstein.
The potassium tartarate that's made the crystals that you could get out of the wine are known as Weinstein. That's what your name means.
Yeah, I better keep that in memory. I didn't know. And it's over.
Okay.
Like Smith now.
Right. That of tartaric acid, which he had permitted in 1912. His tshuva, which subsequently was published in Has Apiezer, volume 3, 33.5, unhesitatingly sanctioned bone gelatin on the grounds that the dry bones were never prohibited by Jewish law. The opinion of these three highly regarded rabbis is substantiated by other world prominent rabbinic leaders, notably Rabbi Isaac Burstein of Ostrolenka, who approved the form of gelatin made from non-kosher fish excretion, and Rabbis Judah Tsirlson of Kishinev and Judah Graubart of Toronto in their respective responses to permitting Rennick. Rabbi Graubart's Shiva was originally published in 1933. It supported an endorsement that Rabbi Parvis had given to Junket, a dessert mix containing rennet made from the dried-up stomach lining of a calf. Further and much broader support for Rabbi Parvis' endorsement came from the Agudat HaRabbanim, in those days the largest and most authoritative body of Orthodox rabbis in the world. A statement published by the Agudat HaRabbanim declared Junket to be kosher in strict compliance with Jewish law. Actually, prior to the statement, the only reservations to Junket were expressed by a recognized rabbinic leader were those of Rabbi Eliezer Silver. Rabbi Parvis, however, conclusively proved Rabbi Silver's doubts had no halakhic validity. That's an opinion. That's not necessarily a statement of historical truth. Okay. It was not until 1950 that Rabbi Gudinsky's approval of heterogelatin became the source of sharp rabbinic controversy. The dispute was initiated by Rabbi Silver, then a presidium member of the Agudat HaRabbanim, who, as we noted above, had harbored some doubt about the kashrut of rennet. Opposed to the heter, or at least to its practical application in America, Rabbi Silver disapproved of the heter given by Rabbis Samuel Baskin and Simon Rudegard to jello, a gelatin dessert made from pig skins as well as cattle hides, and called upon these rabbis to revoke their endorsement. Also, in a letter to numerous colleagues and a published response, Rabbi Silver indirectly took issue with Rabbi Judith L. Zeltzer's endorsement of Kogel, a dessert product made strictly of bone gelatin. yielding to pressure, Rabbi Staskin and Winograd withdrew their hechsher from Jello in November 1951. Rabbi Zeltzer, however, who served many years as executive secretary to the Agudat HaRabbanim, responded to Rabbi Silver's protest in a comprehensive article published in Haparadis of Tammuz 1952, which you have taught. Defending the application of Rabbi Vitzensky's heter to the Jonathan product he was endorsing and citing additional supportive sources, he refuted each of Rabbi Silver's objections and asserted without reservation that the Jonathan made from hard, dry bones is permissible. The same conclusion in separate articles of that issue of Haparadis were reached by Rabbis Eliyahu Henkin and Simcha Elberg. Rabbi Elberg, in particular, after a detailed analysis of all halakhic sources, unequivocally stated, gelatin made from bones that by chemical process become dry as wood and then held ground into powder is surely kosher. In time, the controversy abated and gelatin, especially of bone extraction, began winning increasing acceptance. That's certainly not true. In 1954, Dayan Yecheskel Abramsky ruled that from a purely halakhic standpoint, bone gelatin wasn't deemed kosher, but he questioned the wisdom of officially promulgating it as such for fear that the psak may be misinterpreted. Shortly afterwards, however, Rabbi Tzvi Pesach Frank, chief rabbi of Jerusalem, publicly authorized the use of bone gelatin produced in Belgium under the supervision of the leading rabbis of Antwerp. Rabbis, in 1966, Rabbis Moses Feinstein and Aaron Cutler issued a sponsa allowing gelatin that was produced from kosher slaughtered animals only. In other words, prohibiting gelatin, in effect. While 1 year later, both Rabbi Grossnass of the Vestment of London and Rabbi Kofo Kahana of Jews College approved the gelatin made from chrome leather. I don't know what chrome leather is. In the meantime, Rabbi Shlomo Schreiber, chairman of the Board of Rabbis of Agudas Yisrael in Jerusalem, sanctioned the same bone gelatin previously endorsed by Rabbi Frank. This gelatin was again certified as kosher in 1980 by Rabbi Michael Ehrlich, a member of the Chief Rabbinate of Tel Aviv, and accordingly is used today throughout the state of Israel. That's in 1982. As we know today, it is not used broadly in the state of Israel, except for special circumstances, such as things that are taken for medication, or if it carries with it an additional statement that says, kosher la'ofrei gelatin. So,
what else are the people? Matters
kosher for people who think it's kosher. Kosher for people who think it's kosher. What I would like to do is to work our way through the tshuva of Rav Obadiah Yosef, which commits gelatin. But before we do that, let's read again from this book what the details are about the nature of gelatin and its manufacture. Okay. Gelatin does not occur in nature. It is made by a hydrolytic conversion of collagen, the principal fibrous protein constituent of animal skin, bones, and white connective. The word gelatina is a medieval Latin origin meaning frozen or thickened. That aptly describes the properties of gelatin since the tendency of the substance is to form a gel with water. The raw materials processed commercially consist of skins and bones which contain high proportions of collagen. Gelatin may be obtained directly from these materials by simply boiling them in water. But the rate and quality of extraction are greatly improved by pre-treating the raw materials. The pre-treatment also serves as a basis for classification. Gelatin derived from an acid-treated precursor is known as type A, while gelatin derived from an alkali-treated precursor is known as type B. The raw materials, as well as specific treatment each undergoes to yield gelatin, are described below. A. Manufacturing process. Raw materials. Collagen occurs in most animals, forming the skin and the organic part of the bone. Although gelatin can be derived from cattle, sheep, hogs, and other mammals, as well as fish, birds, and reptiles, in practice, cattle and hogs are the major animal sources used today. Contrary to popular belief, gelatin cannot be obtained from the horns, hoofs, and other non-collagenous parts of animals. Gelatin should not be confused with certain other materials, such as Japanese gelatin or Japanese isinglass, which is vegetable agar, Chinese moss, Irish moss, etc., all of which are extracts from several varieties of seaweed. Neither is there any relation with pectin, a gel-forming substance found in fruit jellies, nor with blasting gelatin, which is a mixture of nitroglycerin and diatomaceous earth. The chief raw materials used in gelatin manufacture are cattle bones, procured from India, South America, and the United States, cattle skins or hide pieces, supplied by the United States, South America, and the United Kingdom, and pork skins supplied only by the United States and Europe. Pre-treatment of raw materials. The production of gelatin begins with the refinement of the collagen-bearing materials. Although each receives a markedly different pre-treatment, the object in all cases is to remove as much fat, mineral matter, and non-collagen protein as possible. Removal of these extraneous substances by chemical and physical means leaves a purified, insoluble collagen, which is then converted by treatment with hot water to soluble gelatin.
If this can boil or fall, do it.
You can, but you get an inferior product. Cattle bones. After cattle are slaughtered, the washed carcass is quartered and sent to the cutting room where it's cut into the portions needed to the consumer. The larger non-marketable bones, known as green bones, are collected separately from the meat and conveyed to a crusher which reduces them to pieces about 2 inches by 3 inches. The bones are cleaned or scrapped from meat, marrow, tendon, and fatty tissue by the use of an organic solvent at a low boiling point or while ultrasonic waves are in aqueous solution. The solvent is distilled off to remove the grease, or in the second instance, the solution is separated from the grease by screens and centrifuges. The bones are also washed in hot water. Afterwards, the bones are leached with dilute hydrochloric acid to remove the mineral part, calcium phosphate, from the organic protein. The resulting sponge-like collagen-bearing material, which represents about 25% of the original bone, is known as ossean. The ossean is steeped in aqueous lime for a period of a month or longer. Liming changes the collagen into a form which can be more readily converted into gelatin. It breaks down intermolecular bridges, which causes a decrease in the cohesion and reorientation of the collagen fibers. It dissolves most of the remaining extraneous matter, such as elastin, albumins, mucopolysaccharides, etc., and removes certain impurities that may have a cohesive action on the collagen. The fragments resulting from the rupture of the collagen chain are thus easily dissolved in hot water extraction. In either the HCl or lime soak, the raw material undergoes irreversible and structural change. After liming, the ossean is washed with cold water to remove excess alkali. It is then neutralized overnight in either a hydrochloric or sulfuric acid solution to achieve the desired pH of the gelatin product, usually 4.7 to 6.0, and then rewashed. The ossean has now picked up several times its weight in water, feels soft and spongy, and is ready for gelatin extraction. So that's what they do with bones. Then he goes on to describe how cattle skin is processed and how pork skin is processed. Despite the differences in pre-treatment, the conversion of the raw materials to gelatin is similar in all three cases. Extraction is carried out in a batch type operation with successive portions of hot water at progressively higher temperatures until the maximum yield is obtained. The raw material is transferred to large stainless steel tanks where it is heated with steam and water. It is at this point that the chemical reaction of hydrolysis takes place, converting the insoluble purified collagen into soluble protein. During the heating period, the water which now contains the gelatin solution is continually withdrawn, and 3 to 5 hot water extractions are made, these being designated as first run, second run, etc. Each is carried out at a slightly higher temperature than the one previous, the last extraction occurring at about 100 degrees centigrade. The reason for this system is to prevent the breakdown of the gelatin molecule, which increases with the rise in temperature. Therefore, extraction occurs at the minimum temperature that will produce the satisfactory yield. Gel strength decreases with each run. The first run has the highest gel strength, or the last one has very low gel strength. Gelatin solutions are colorless, with straw color, clear, and flavorless. From each extraction, hundreds of gallons of gelatin solution are drawn off. The solution is centrifuged to remove any residual solids and is filtered to remove microscopic impurities. It is concentrated by vacuum evaporation, poured onto a moving belt, and sent to a refrigerated chamber where it is gelled rapidly in sheet form. The gelatin sheet is transferred to wide screens and dried in warm ovens. To hasten the drying process, newer techniques employ chilling rotators to which the liquor is extruded as cold gelled noodles. These fall into a continuous wire mesh belt and, like the gelatin sheets, proceed to the drying ovens. When the moisture of the gelatin is reduced to 10%, the sheets or noodles are ground to the desired particle size and tested for quality and grade. So that's the actual production process.
Mm-hmm.
it's complicated, and the halakhic issues that are involved here are, first of all, Chahev Desifa. Vani Magish B'chol Hashem Shel Hadrasha Ki Zer Damti B'chol Chome HaShela Rak Mitzad HaHikati B'chein Chol Dibreya B'chol Dibreya Hem Rak Lahal Lacha V'ulah Kedei Shelo Yotzei Mishel Kedai Im HaTanayim Hashim Hotzi Takana U'lasor Tato Etzer Etzol Yalat. So basically he says it's permissible, but he's not going under to the rabbis who want to prohibit it. And similarly, as was pointed out, Rabbi Raskin and others retracted their hafsher from jello, but then demanded also that the hafsher from kojel also could be back. And I don't want to summarize. Some of these articles are rather interesting. For instance, Rabbi Seltzer's response to Rabbi Silver, in which he rejects the the claim that Rabbi Buchheim was a change of his mind. We heard that story before on the issue of the note of the Yehuda, and the arguments against his having changed his mind were the same, namely, if he had changed his mind, he should have said it somewhere. So now, I want to get out of the American scene and get into the Israeli scene, or more specifically, out of the Ashkenazi world and into the Sephardi world, where the notion of authority is a little bit more hierarchical. So this is from Obadiah Yosef. I don't have a date here. Is there a date at the end? No. Kashuot HaJelot in Bahalacha. Does everyone have a copy? Should be going around. I'm passing around Yavia Omer, Kashrut HaJelot in Bahalacha. Hine Yitzur HaJelotin. We go road, Omer Tzamot Rakim, Shel Behemot Nevelot Tzrefot, Omer Behemot Tzmeyot. So first of all, that's not 100% correct, because it's primarily made from the hard bone, not necessarily from the, what do you call it? How do you translate it? Cartilage. Not from the cartilage. That cartilage also will go into it. Sheshorim oto b'melech b'sid, u'menakim oto hekev, u'myavshim oto harvei b'chol ha'shemesh b'meshach kama chadashim, u'ma'arvim bahem chomorim kimiyim usuyamim, u'tochanim oto b'natsim kemach dam. So they make it into a powder. U'notnum oto b'makalim shalim k'dei l'hakiyam. And they put them in various foodstuffs in order to gel them. And the reason for the permissibility of this, Mish'an, al-divrei ha-ramah v'hagar yuradeh, v'shem ha-shibuleh ha-leket, or ha-keva, the skin of the stomach, shemolkin u'myavshim oto, which is salted and then completely dry, u'mamalim oto chalav mutav. It's permissible. Shikran. Shem ke-mikevan shem mitnavei sha'or, ha-vi ka'ev tva'alma. Since the skin of the stomach, the wall of the stomach has been completely dried, it's like a piece of wood. The ein lo shum lachu put basav. V'cheinu b'beit Yosef sham. So that's also in the Beit Yosef. So the idea here is that once this thing has become completely dry, it lost its status of being an object which is prohibited. Amnam hanori b'Yehuda kam l'chel b'Yehuda simon hachav nish'al odot l'chubit sholdat tamei shemiyakshim oto harvei v'notnim oto l'oto chavit shel yayin or l'oto mashke shel meivash kedei l'hashkia at ha'shmarim shel ha'yayin l'mata. It was asked about isinglass, which is put into wine or mei in order to clarify it so that all the particles sink to the bottom. And that's done even today with beer and also gelatin. It's used moving to clarification of apple juice, for example. They also brought proof from this folks' permission that Rabbi Isildes gave to the dried skin of the stomach. Mishum shekivan shin yavesh havekeiv v'alma v'katav. Ulam omer ani, I say shemuvad shehashach katav v'lachatila ein lasot kein. O nirah devanida dandan afilu beyaved yesh le'esol. In our case, even after the fact, it should be prohibited. The shiny hatam sheor hakeiva heterahu. Because there, the stomach itself was permissible. There, it was talking about a permissible piece of meat which had become completely dried, and therefore, even though milk came in contact with it, no flavor was given to the milk from the meat. Aval hashloko it. But the slim bladder, sheish al dag tameh ve'asura min atzara, kvar chala la'ashen yisur, v'lo nirkam imenu ha'yisur gamu achar shem yitiyadesh, ela im kein yitiyabshana gamu yit ad shenisola gamu le'achila keret. But here, in order to apply this, it has to become so dry that it becomes unfit for animal food. Sheharei be'yavod azara nechrukur rabi meir v'roh shimon, there's a statement that you're supposed to give the nevela to the ger, meaning that a nevela, which is such a state of decomposition, that it's not fit for human consumption, doesn't have the status of isur. And the Gemara in Rav Zara has a dispute between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Shimon as to what this means. According to Rabbi Meir, this means that if you had some object of nevela which comes from such a sick animal that the animal, before it died, had become so putrid that its meat was not edible to any human, then it doesn't have any status of prohibition. Whereas Rabbi Shimon says that even if you had a piece of good meat, a solid piece of steak, which was quite edible, but then became decomposed to such a state in which it was not fit for human consumption, it lost its status of this. They say if it's unfit to give to a ger, then you have no prohibition about it either. The ruling is that prohibited foodstuffs which have become unfit for human consumption lose their status of this. But the issue is, what is this referring to? Is this referring to foodstuffs which have become prohibited and then decompose to such a state that they're not fit for human consumption? That's Rabbi Shimon's position. And Rabbi Meir's position is that foodstuffs which have not yet become prohibited will not become prohibited if they're unfit for human consumption. The borderline case here being foodstuffs which are not normally fit, normally a human would not eat these, but they're still fit for the dog, fit for animal consumption. Okay? If you use it as dog food. And the difference of opinion is between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Shimon as to whether something which has already become prohibited can lose its status of being prohibited if it becomes unfit for human consumption. That's the difference of opinion between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Shimon. And the note of Yehuda in this long shuva that we didn't study, because I knew we would be able to get a summary of it here, was that you have to worry that perhaps Rabbi Meir's position is correct, which means that prohibited food, which has been degenerated to the state where it's unfit for human consumption, does not necessarily lose its status of prohibition. That's the issue. And I don't want to go into the technical details, which will occupy about a page and a half or more of this tshuva, in which Rabbi Avadu Yosef says that even though the Noda B'Yehuda seems to feel that there's no clear-cut evidence whether the ruling should follow Rabbi Meir or Rabbi Shimon, he deduces a whole lot of evidence that the Noda B'Yehuda was unnecessarily rigid, and that in fact the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon, and therefore foodstuffs which have become prohibited foodstuffs which have become unfit for human consumption would normally lose their status of being prohibited. So that occupies until where? I'll take it down to the paragraph 4.
So this is where it comes to the human consumption, where I get back to the end.
For animal consumption, correct. All right. So he, to summarize, what he concludes is that if you have the stomach of an animal which became so sufficiently dry that it was unfit for human consumption, then you can store it, you can use it to curdle your milk or store your milk in it because it has lost its status of potency. That's step one.
That's how you conceive of whatever you're saying. It's like a double negative.
No. He's saying that if, all that he's saying is that foodstuffs which have been prohibited but have degenerated to such a state in which they're not fit for human consumption, lost their status of prohibition.
No longer prohibited.
No longer prohibited. That's what he has to argue in this. He has this position of the Ramah, which says that a dried stomach can be used to store milk in, or to curdle milk. Okay? And now the issue is, what kind of a stomach is he talking about? Is he talking about the stomach of a kosher animal, in which case the problem is less severe because the meat itself is not prohibited, and if the meat no longer gives any flavor to the milk, you don't really have a mixture of meat and milk. Or is he also talking about the stomach of an animal which was not properly slaughtered? In which case, what you have is a principle that says that if you had a prohibited piece of meat, like the stomach of this animal, and it dried to such an extent that it became unfit for human consumption, and then you use it as a curdling agent, it's still permissible.
The what for the milk?
The milk.
Oh, but not the, they're not going to eat it. Well, they're actually, what cheese is made that way.
Yes, right, cheese was made that way.
That's so bad.
All right, now let's come back to a familiar topic. ואנוכי רואה בשאלת ותשובות תפי הצבי שנשאל אודות תולעים אדומים about our bugs שמייבשים אותם that are dry וצובים בהם המשקי יין שרף. Your Campari, the red Campari is made with a mixture of these bugs. והשיב להתיר על פי מה שכתב הרמה בדין קיבה שנתייבשה שמותר לתן לתוכה חלב והוא הדין לתולה עם אלו. So you're allowed to drink red Campari made, if assuming that the wine was kosher, made from bugs which give it the red coloring, like the salami that we had last week. ויאף על פי שהנודה ביהודה כתב לחלק בזה בין דבר שהחלה לא צורך ניסיון מיקרו לבין הקיבה של משפיטה כשרה וכל עוד ומוכן הרגלן ויאף שהתוספות שם כתבו לחלק בין ניסו לא יתאו לגמור בכל מקום יש לפרש תקוייהם בעניין אחר הצד ואולם לדעתי כבר פחוקים בשתי דברי התוספות ועל כל פנים בתמיישת שאין בו טעם כלל אין לאסור ולא לדמרי לדבר הפגום לא בעד Still cough, but neither did not able to use to recall out came to this brought up. So this is a summary of what he said. He allowed the use of cochineal or kermes, except at that time it was kermes, as the coloring agent. And last week we saw Umi Sefer Lam Amlo Eis, in the book Me Amlo Eis, the Pasuk Fitolah Shanit Katav. We studied this last week. יש אילנות שגדלים בהם פירות קטנים קדשים ובכל קרי יש קניית עולאים קטנים המלאים דם ולוחצים מאוד זה על גבזם יבשים הפירות הללו בשמש בימי תמוז ואב יחד כך שרים אותם במים והמים נעשים אדומים כדם ומן הקלורים האלו יש בזה קוראים קרמיז That's the origin of our English word crimson. ונותנים הקרמיז במרקחת today she can move 7 or 8. 80 servers then. They used to use this to color candies. The 80 servers that came in Shakalavim, the Gamshim, the Shemesh, and Arsak, Arsaba Alam. The Gam, the Kedim, and the Shishi. The Shechen, the Allah, Mars, the Stel, the Old, my Rabbi, the Moshe, the Pugger, the Chubak, the Gatiad, Arkan.
What will be the sale to the Shishi, and would it make any difference with Arsaba, the Alma, or not? If you allow the 160 to take place.
He's giving two different reasons why. One is that these things have become just dust. They've just become a chemical powder. They've lost their identity as being worms or bugs. And secondly, they become negligible because you have more than six. And remember, we studied the Chilodem Aramim Rukhavi last week, and we learned there that he was primarily concerned with the fact that just as the reason if something gives a flavor, therefore its identity is noticeable, it renders the whole mixture prohibited, do we have to worry about the fact that if something gives a color, it renders the whole mixture prohibited? And he said, no, hazuta lav milta. That as far as foodstuffs are concerned, the fact that your ingredient happens to be noticeable by virtue of color as opposed to be noticeable by virtue of taste does not allows the thing to be butthead. You can consider it as negligence. Okay, so he's now bringing the whole list of Sephardic sources which allow the use of kermes. We only have the one source of Rabbi Weiss who allowed the colored salami last week, but so okay. Now let's now skip to paragraph 5 on page 5. ולכאורה, יש להוסיף עוד נימוק היתר בנידן דדם. We can add an additional reason to permit the gelatin in our case. הולילו בתהליך התוצרת של הגלטין מן האור העצמות, ויחר שנתייבשו היטב בשמש במשך כמה חרשים, מעורים בהם מלאכים חיביים ותוכנים אותם הדק היטב עד שנפח הכל לירק דק. It's all been converted into a fine powder. ופנים חדשות באו כאן, עם התרכובת שבהם. And this is now a new substance. יש לדנות דבר זה למה שכתב רבינו יונה, שהמוס כאן ניקח מתוך היה ידועה שיש לו הפרטות לו בצברה, הוא מתכוון לשם תחילה כאין דם, ואחר כך נעשה מוס שיש בריח טוב ונותן כאן משפח ותעשיר ומרחפת, יש טעם להתירו באכילה משום דפיר שבעלנו. ואף על פי שמתפילה הידם אין לחוש לכך, תבואת ההשפעה הזמינת. שהרי הדש, הדבש, שנפלו בתוך חקיקת ייצור, אף על פי שנמוכה בתוך הדבש, כיוון שדרך הדבש להחזיר הדבר שלו פועל בתוך הדבש, כדי נדש בהם ומותר. והחינם היא אף על פי שמתפילה הידם, כיוון שיצא מתורתם, בת ההשפעה הזמינת, תלכר אף על פי שנותן פעם לשפעת הפרשיר, ומכחת מותר עד כאן. So this, we studied this in detail 2 weeks ago, I believe, on the study of the musk. And it's a bit of a comedy of errors, because first of all, the musk deer is probably a kosher animal, not a non-kosher animal. And secondly, the musk itself is not blood, which has been converted into something else, but it's a secretion from this musk deer. But in any event, Rabbeinu Yonah assumed that it was a non-kosher animal, and it was something that was converted from blood, and introduced the principle that once the form of the substance has changed so completely it becomes permissible. The dope we may hope to be activated.
And then if you bring in this flash,
he said that also some portions of an insect or even a piece of meat are soaked in the sugar, they become crystallized, or sugarified. Again, I don't know what the appropriate word is. Whatever the word is, the substance has been converted from whatever it was, flesh, into sugar crystals. And therefore, it's an entirely new substance, and therefore, you don't have to worry about it.
This is not true.
Partially true. Okay. At any event, the principle that was enunciated by Rabbi Niyona, which we studied in detail 2 weeks ago, says that if you have a complete change of form of the substance, then it also has lost its identity and it's not to be dealt with as davar yotzei min hatameh o min haisur. And he says, v'dok minei v'oki v'yakli, and just examine that reasoning and apply it here. This powder, whatever it is, in the process of being treated with chemicals and converted into powder, etc., etc., has lost its original identity and characteristic, and now should be considered with something completely new. The Akal Pisha Rosh Sham Katav al Dibreva Ben Yonah Venera Shahiva Ayatotsi Kora Ayah, that the Rosh